The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, welcome to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Mike Verkess sitting in with Eric Bauer and Dr. Jim DeCanto. We're going to talk about the state of ventilation and ventilators right now, really across the world. So first thing I want to do is check in with Eric. How are you doing, my friend?
Hey, doing good. Hope everybody is staying safe out there. We thought we would bring Dr. DeCanto on here and get his expertise on mechanical ventilation in, you know, maybe some different ways of applying this in a state of need right now.
Probably an understatement in most people's opinions that we are overtaxed right now. So Dr. DeCanto, good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Happy to have you. Dr. DeCanto, why don't you take a couple minutes for maybe some of those that don't know you, a little background on you, and then why don't you get right into the state of ventilators across the world right now in this COVID-19 crisis?
Well, guys, I'm an anesthesiologist. I've been in practice in Milwaukee since 1997, coming up on 23 years here in a single hospital, largest private hospital in Wisconsin, St. Luke's Medical Center. I've always been interested in airway management even before I became a physician. It was many, many years ago. I learned quite a bit about demand valves when I got certified to scuba dive. And when I went into medicine, I was oddly drawn to anesthesiology and respiratory medicine. I completed a residency in anesthesiology in 1996 in Chicago at Rush University, Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center, and I ended up moving to another hospital a year later, almost with the same name, St. Luke's Medical Center. Been fascinated with airway management, basic as well as advanced. And approximately 12 years ago, I came into the possession of a device I'll talk about tonight, which is called the oscillator. Which is potentially something that can help us with what's going on in the world today. So as we all know through media and some of the hyperbole that's been thrown out there, that we are facing a situation where we are running out of ventilation machines, ventilators. And we're beginning as a community of healthcare providers to innovate towards extending the existing equipment and also potentially using some new ventilator equipment that really sits in the province of pre-hospital medicine.
All right, that is a great introduction. Thanks for doing that. So there's been a lot of information flying around out there, a lot of do-it-yourselfers, and I'm using the air quotes when it comes to people trying to be innovative and trying to come up with ways to support multiple patients from a single device, 4 patients on 1 ventilator, 2 patients on 1 ventilator. What is your take on all that you're seeing out there on social media and kind of making the rounds?
Well, of course, I had to assemble my own version of putting 2 patients on the same ventilator. But if you read between the lines and you pay attention to what you're really doing, you'll realize that that's not going to be a practical solution. And indeed, we are seeing some statements by the American Society of Anesthesiology, the Society for Critical Care Medicine, as well as my own state Society of Respiratory Care Medicine, that is cautioning us not to do something foolish like try to share a ventilator between multiple patients. It's just a bad idea. It's almost as if you're asking for a game of tug of war between the patients, and quite literally, it's going to be a process of natural selection, and the strong, they're going to, just like in the movie Highlander, there can only be one. The stronger patient will suffocate the weaker patient. It's a bad idea.
And Eric, I know you sent me that position statement from the Society of Critical Care Medicine earlier today. What was your take on that?
Well, you know, I get a lot of emails and text messages, and I've been receiving tons of stuff on that exact topic. I know it was brought up on the Foam Frat podcast that Tyler and Sam did with Leon. You know, and they kind of pushed away from that as well. But, you know, I think you have these programs out there that are trying to think outside the box. I'm not faulting them for that. At the same time, even though, you know, I may have written a few books on mechanical ventilation. I mean, there are a lot of people out there that are experts well above me. And so I always feel very uncomfortable when I receive stuff like that, because I don't, number one, I'm not a physician. And number two, I'm not going to give advice on something like that. So it is uncomfortable for me. So I really actually loved seeing that position paper. It made me feel like my gut instinct was correct and kind of gave me some relief, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I completely understand that. Jim, have you taken care of anybody, a COVID patient at all that's been on a ventilator?
Not as of yet, guys. We've stopped elective cases at my hospital, and I haven't had the duty yet to take care of anybody with COVID-19. As of yet, all I know are reports from colleagues, mostly in emergency medicine.
I mean, are you comfortable talking about the things you've been hearing from your colleagues?
Well, you know, in all honesty, I just know that what's being conveyed to me is that how incredibly fast these patients are going from being ventilating on their own with supplemental oxygen, anywhere from 2 to 4 to 6 liters a minute of oxygen, and then suddenly precipitously needing to be rescued and intubated and ventilated. This is just basically the only information I have. I have a colleague here in Wisconsin who communicated with me that she took care of a patient with this disease, and he was a tremendously difficult airway, both physiologically as well as physically, due to basically this infection. And this patient was very, very quick to desaturate on her. So what I'm being told is that they're tremendously fragile individuals. And it just underscores that first pass success is absolutely completely key in these patients. If you have to take a second go at them, there's a chance they're going to arrest on you. So you got to get it on the first try.
Yeah, I would add to that, not to interrupt, Mike. I think the same things that we talked about on the last podcast on COVID-19, and then thinking about, you know, the droplet transmission and, you know, the whole nasal cannula aspect and passive oxygenation and really thinking about using a BVM. And, you know, we don't have the same tools, or we're trying not to use the same tools to try to mitigate and limit that exposure potential. So I think earlier these patients are intubated is the big thing that I'm hearing. I haven't taken care of a patient yet. But I think that is the key. I'm hearing the exact same things.
That's one of the moves that we made in our protocols. We just did an adjustment to our airway protocols. And, you know, it's essentially all but saying that DL is forbidden at this point. We're going to use VL, period. Maximize that first pass success. Use your bougies. Use all the normal things that you would typically use to manage this. You know, if you got to use a supraglottic, that's fine. However, just be aware that it is a continuously aerosol generating device that you've just placed on that patient. And another little piece that's just an airway tidbit. I know we're sort of in the weeds a little bit here, but making sure that you inflate that cuff before you deliver those first breaths, or else you're going to be generating more aerosol.
Yeah, good point.
Good point.
That brings us back to kind of the state of the nation, if you will, on ventilators. So we're short on ventilators. We're going to be long on patients. Those two things don't necessarily match. And I know that there was recently an article published from the New York Times that they interviewed you, Dr. DeCanto, as part of that. Really, the question is, what are we going to be able to do about this situation? Now, there's a lot of stuff out there in the media. There's the national push to have some of these other manufacturers, so like a car manufacturer, to start making ventilators and things like that. But that's not likely to produce much in the short time here. What else is going on out there that people can sort of start looking at?
Well, we do have many of us many of you guys in the critical care paramedic community know all about transport ventilators. I think what we're going to do is we're going to have to introduce devices that are typically used for the patient transport to substitute for these full function ventilators. We are also at my institution emptying out space to utilize operating rooms with the anesthesia machines to provide ventilation. So one of the things that we can do for surge capacity is we can utilize anesthesia systems As a matter of fact, the anesthesia machine can provide the sedation without a lot of intravenous medications. We can just turn the gas on the patient. That's a big advantage. The other thing we can do is we can look at transport ventilators. I think I know the name of your favorite transport ventilator, Eric, simply by hanging out with Tyler Cristofoli long enough. It starts with an H, and there's a famous Broadway play based on it. Anyway, one of the things that I was interviewed about was a technology known as the oxlator. This is a device that I became familiar with about 12 years ago when I attended a meeting of the Society for Airway Management in Boston. I was presented with a mass casualty simulation when I first laid eyes on the thing, and I was very quick to pick it up. It's a very strange little gadget. It's technologically descended from something called a demand valve. And those among us who have seen these things, they're quite old. I don't remember when they were phased out, but likely by the early 90s, these things were phased out of clinical care and pre-hospital medicine. What's your guys' experience on that?
Yeah, same. Like, I think there was a hat tip to them, at least in some of my early textbooks from going through EMT and paramedic. But boy, I don't know that I've ever seen one even in real life. Eric, what about you?
No, I agree. No, we were taught about them and never used them. I think they were definitely being phased out.
That's right. You know, I can hand you a machine, and if you're not very good with it, you can turn anything into a weapon. As a matter of fact, Scott Weingart does a lecture called "The Laryngoscope as Murder Device," basically, indeed. Demand valves were pretty tricky unless you were very gentle and watched the patient. Now, how does the oxlator differ from a demand valve? It is a device that senses flow and pressure in real time. Its valve has been measured at a 20 millisecond response rate to changes in flow and pressure. The device will not allow you to overpressurize a patient beyond the setting that you put on the device. It's essentially small, about the size of a 12-ounce can of soda. It relies on a high-pressure gas source, either from a tank or from the central supply of a hospital or an ambulance. And in an emergency, it can even be run on an air compressor, whether it's a medical or a consumer air compressor. Ideally, you use a medical air compressor. I can speak knowledgeably about that device, as I've been a possibly what they would call a super user. I utilize it chiefly as a transport ventilator within my hospital when I'm required to take a patient from an operating room to a CT scanner and then off to an ICU. I utilize the device as a transport device, so usually I'm getting 20-minute transports out of the device. I also can utilize it to help me anesthetize the patient. And when I mean anesthetize, really what I'm doing is I'm performing lung recruitment maneuvers and I'm denitrogenating the patient. I'm really, really thoroughly washing the patient out with oxygen. And it is truly a remarkable device when used with face mask ventilation. It can also be used, of course, with a tracheal tube or with a supraglottic airway. Most of the market for this in the United States has been pre-hospital in the southern United States, southeast United States to be exact, Georgia, Virginia, and Florida. And the largest sales have been mostly to units of the United States Army and Air Force. So there has been a huge military use of these devices.
Why is the military using this particular device? Are they finding it that it's, like, what are the benefits they're seeing that they're wanting to use this device?
I think the benefits are its simplicity and the fact that it doesn't break down. It's all hearsay when I tell you that I've heard that other transport ventilators are not robust enough to tolerate the environments that these devices are hauled through. But what is a fact is that the oxlator is robust enough to be brought into all sorts of different kinds of environments, theaters of war and such. The largest service to adopt this is actually the entire EMS system of Quebec, Canada, uses these pre-hospital.
I do have a few questions. So is there the ability to add a PEEP on these?
With the stock device, the device will hold four centimeters of PEEP.
Okay.
There is a new attachment that was originally actually designed to turn the oxlator into a self-contained breathing apparatus for use in underground mining rescue. That particular attachment, which we are now making available commercially, allows the attachment of a PEEP valve so that you can use an off-the-shelf PEEP valve with a 22-millimeter connector. So a PEEP valve essentially is a 30-millimeter female connector. If you have the attachment that has the 30-millimeter male that goes to the 22-millimeter male, yeah, that's it. It's a male-to-male connector. That will adapt to the oscillator.
This is obviously pneumatically driven based on the O2 supply. How does it compare? Are you able to dial down that FiO2? You know, how efficient is it? I mean, I think that's one of the things that we have a problem with pre-hospitally in some of these small CPAP, standalone devices that are not mechanically ventilated, BiPAP devices or modes. How does it compare?
So the gas consumption is essentially 15 liters per minute because it flows 30 liters a minute on the I phase and 0 liters per minute on the E phase. And it's got an IDE ratio of 1 to 1.2. So you're consuming 15 liters per minute of gas per minute. An E cylinder, I don't think you guys carry those, but that's what we have in hospitals. The E cylinder will provide the oscillator with about 40 to 45 minutes of operation. As far as reducing the FiO2, for you to do that, you'd have to supply the oscillator with a lower FiO2. You would need a mixing manifold to do that if you're in a hospital. If you wanted to do that pre-hospitally, the device can be run on air, and the oxygen can be, what do you call it when you slip it in? Is it called, not trickled in, it's called, there's a term for it.
Are you talking about blow-by?
Yeah, it's bled in. Bleed in. You can bleed in the oxygen. The way you would do that is you would actually connect a oxygen extension tubing from a tank or from the wall spigot to the capnography port on a HEPA filter. And that would allow you to bleed in oxygen at a rate of anywhere from 1 to 8 liters a minute. So if you run the device on air and you bleed in 8 liters a minute of oxygen, you'll get a 50 to 55% FiO2. If you use less oxygen, you have a lower FiO2. So that would be the way in which we would conserve oxygen with this device, but it would require you to run it off of an air tank or off of an air compressor to do it.
So I think the thing that's intriguing about this device, you know, especially in times like this, is the simplicity of it. And I think as long as you have plentiful oxygen supply and you're not worried about that aspect, I can definitely see this being a very simple device that you could hand to somebody that doesn't have a lot of mechanical ventilation or airway training and teach them easily how to operate this in times like this. So I think that's where the military probably finds this very attractive. It's small, it's compact, it's simple to use.
Correct. Yes. So if I were to train you very quickly, I would say to you, turn the dial to a higher pressure to make sure the patient has a deep enough breath. That's what I would say to you. Then I would say, do you see how the patient's getting too much of a deep breath? Turn the pressure release lower. So the device flows until it reaches the point at which it reaches the pressure set on the dial, and then it cycles to an exhalation phase, and then it immediately starts up again after basically maintaining PEEP. You adjust the device to the patient by setting the pressure at which you get a 1 second inhalation time, which is 500 milliliters of gas. 1 second is 500 milliliters. That's also equivalent to 30 liters a minute, by the way. The oscillator is an affordable solution for pre-hospital and in-hospital care in this very difficult situation we're facing. What would likely make sense for those within the systems that are considering this is that they partner with their respiratory therapy colleagues to use the, usually you guys have a right respirometer, so you can look at the tidal volumes with a test lung. I want you guys to get these devices, evaluate them, understand how they work with a test lung, and then when push comes to shove, you can use this device clinically. But to simply take it out of the box, connect the cable to the device, and connect the cable to a source is irresponsible. You have to dry lab this so that you're comfortable understanding how to adjust it. You can learn fast enough using a test lung. You don't have to try this on a patient to understand it. The test lung will tell you everything you need to know. Then you go from the test lung, you go to a patient. The easiest thing for you to do with this device in the very beginning is to use it as a transport ventilator, which means you're going to use it for a short period of time so that if you experience any difficulties with it, you simply switch over to a different your usual method of transport ventilation, whether that's a bag valve device or an actual ventilator.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. DeCanto, for joining us for this. Eric, any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I think looking at this and reading on this, I think it solves some problems. We definitely talk about this in our courses that, you know, BVMs are great. And I think, you know, a BVM is a phenomenal tool, but it's really easy to give too many breaths. It's real easy to generate a high pressure where we're now putting a lot of that volume into the stomach. Our breaths, if we give that breath too rapidly, that does obviously just that increases that pressure. And we get variable volumes. We know we can give volumes as high as 1500 mils. So I think that this definitely solves some major problems with current technology. And I know that there's some new BVMs out there that take care of some of that stuff. But, you know, in times like these where we have a limited amount of supply, you know, you're going to use whatever you can use. And this is definitely solving a problem.
Agree. Any final thoughts, Dr. DeCanto? And we'll get on out of here.
The last thing I want to say is I want you all to really pay attention to maintaining your safety at all as best as you can. I realize that you're all being put in tremendously difficult situations, that you're all facing a respiratory infectious disease. And I think this is the time for you to be tremendously careful. If you have PPE, don't at any time think that you're saving time or that you're doing a better job if you compromise your safety. I want you to be able to come through 2020 healthy and decent. I want you to come through this, and I want you to be better at what you do as a result of the adversity that you face.
Well said. All right. Well, I will close us out. So on behalf of Eric Bauer and Dr. Jim DeCanto, this is Mike Verkest, and you've been listening to the FlightBridge Ed podcast, the flagship podcast of the FlightBridge Ed podcast network and a Fire Dog production. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the FlightBridge Ed podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.